Hello and welcome to Slate Money Goes to the Movies. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Elizabeth Spires of Slate and the New York Times and such places.
Hello.
I'm here with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hello, hello.
And also, this is the bit that is getting everybody here unbelievably excited. We are here with the one and only Paula Scher. Paula, welcome.
Thank you.
Paula, introduce yourself. Who are you?
I'm Paula Scher. I am a graphic designer and a partner of Pentagram Design. And I live in New York and I like what I do.
And we here at Slate Money, good friends of your fellow Pentagram partner, Michael Beirut, who's been on the show a few times and who sent us an email a couple of weeks ago saying, guys, you really need to have Paula Scher on to talk about This Is Spinal Tap. And the minute I got that email, I was like, well, yes, obviously. So that's exactly what we're doing coming up.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's start at the beginning. Paula, when did you first see this movie? Do you remember the first time you saw this movie?
I saw the movie shortly after it came out in 1984. And to be honest with you, I thought it was docudrama because I worked in the music industry. It was not that far-fetched. As a matter of fact, so many things in the movie were taken from things I knew and experienced. It was bizarre. It took me 5 years to really laugh at it.
Did you have to leave the industry before you found it funny?
Well, I pretty much did. I had left CBS Records in 1982, and I started my own company, and I was designing for a former head of CBS Records named Bruce Lundvall, who had moved to Capitol, and he had started a label that I designed called Manhattan Records. And I was at the very end of that work when Spinal Tap came out. But the music industry was so much part of my life at that point that I thought, oh, look at this documentary they made.
What were some things that were realistic in the movie that struck you as like, this is something that happens all the time?
Well, some of the things were just true. For example, when I worked at Atlantic Records, there was an album called Roxy Music, and there were sort of cleavage exposed on these women. So to get it into the record store, they covered it with like a very dark green plastic, you know, very similar to the smell of the glove analogy. And there at CBS Records, there was an album called Silver Blue, and there were two guys who had leashes around women's necks,
oh my God,
just like the actual description of the album cover, only they didn't cover it with the plastic, but the album was a flop anyway, so nobody cared. And there was also a woman who worked at CBS Records who was the head of publicity, who was chic and always wore Chanel, and her name was Susan Blonde, and Fran Dresser imitated her.
Well, what exactly do you find offensive?
Ian,
I mean, what's
you
offensive?
You put a greased, naked woman, yes, on all fours,
yes,
with a dog collar
a
around
dog collar.
Her neck and a leash.
And a leash.
And a man's arm extended out up to here, holding on to the leash and pushing a black glove in her face to sniff it. You don't find that offensive?
No.
You don't,
I don't.
Find that sexist?
This is 1982.
That's
Bobby.
Right,
come
it's
on.
1982. Get out of the 60s. We don't have this mentality anymore.
I mean, it was amazing. I even when I see it, I still laugh. But when I saw it, I was shocked. I thought, oh my God, there's somebody playing Susan Blonde in the movie. And of course she was.
And so this was a deeply, like on the one hand, famously, this movie is entirely improvised. I think,
right,
except for sort of one line by Patrick McNee, the entire movie is improvised. But also it sounds as though it was deeply researched, and or it just so happened that all of these comic actors were also so deeply immersed in the music industry that they knew all of these things.
Well, I think the second is likely true. And later in the 80s, I became a good friend of Tony Hendra's. And he, you know, the whole movie was ad-libbed, and they knew what they were talking about. I mean, you know, there was a connection between the music industry and sort of the comedy and humor of the time, like National Lampoon, and then the early Saturday Night Live. So there was a sort of a connection between things that actually happened. And then, of course, a lot of it was just music business press and the gestalt of that entire industry. I mean, you know, it was insanity working in that industry, but, you know, you came to accept it as normal. So when I saw the movie first in 1984, I had missed the humor because it was part of my daily life.
You didn't realize you were working in a comedy.
It was beyond comedy. And, you know, in a funny way, it would have made a great sitcom because you would go into the day and there would be the office politics of the building and the sort of the behaviors of the people who worked there, which were insane to begin with. And then you would have recording artists coming up and dealing with it. So it's sort of like having guest stars of the week, if you were thinking of it as a sitcom. So there'd be, you know, so the central casting and where I lived in the in-house art department, which was insanity enough. And then this other ingredient thrown upon it.
And one of the weird things about this movie, and one of the things that makes it feel almost restrained in a way, is there's lots of talk of sex and drugs and rock and roll, and there's lots of rock and roll, but you don't actually see that much in terms of the sex and drugs. It's like the actual music industry was incredibly debauched in a way that, in a weird way, this movie is not.
Well, I think that the humor is, you know, broad and not. It's not mean, and it's not trying to categorize things in such a way to make value judgments. I mean, it's just more of the absurdity of the situation and the success. And of course, you know, the ending of the movie, when they make the hit in Japan, was like so many recording artists on the CBS Records label. Like, I used to do Cheap Tricks covers, and I think we did maybe four or five albums that were never very successful. Until they went to Japan and recorded live at Budokan. And then it brought back all the other albums. I mean, that was just a truism. So the things they put in about the business that seemed absurd are actually things that really happened in real life. And, you know, now when I see it, and I watched it just last week because I knew we were going to talk to, and of course I remembered everything. It's hilariously funny because it's stupid and absurd. And I think that that when you get into the sort of dangerous part of it, like the sex and the rock and drug part of the business, and there was a lot of it, it would actually take away some of the jubilance of that whole experience of these nuts. You know, they were actually, if you think about the band and the way they're portrayed, they're sort of talented guys. You know, they're sort of talented guys who are silly and babyish, you know, and the business seems absurd. And, you know, like the record cover is, whether it's sexy or sexism, I mean, you know, that sort of thing would happen back then.
As we all know, there is a fine line between stupid and clever, but there's also a fine line between movies and rock and roll, right? There's always been a sort of porous back and forth between the two. You've had, you know, movie stars becoming rock and roll artists. You've had rock and roll artists becoming movie stars. You have everyone from David Bowie to J-Lo, you know, sort of just kind of moving back and forth willy-nilly. And I feel like that this was one of those movies where, like, you know, it was obviously made as a movie. It was, you know, featured a bunch of actors. But then Spinal Tap started touring. They started releasing actual records. and it works because, like, on some level, the music industry loves that.
Well, it's its own fantasy land that's also real, you know, so that, of course, they would do that. You know, I mean, that's not surprising to me at all. You'd make the album, then you'd do the tour, then the tour would become a film, and then you would recycle the film as something else, and might even wind up as a Broadway play. You know, I mean, it just you kept reserving the same meal in different plates.
I mean, in this movie was, I guess everyone listening already knows what it's about, but we should just say, you know, it was the first mockumentary, I think, of its kind. You know, it's a fake documentary about a rock band called Spinal Tap that's been around for too long and has been through many iterations and is now, I guess, over the hill at 45. Although from the perch of 2023, 45 doesn't seem over the hill for a rock band. We have like the Rolling Stones now touring, sponsored by AARP.
Yes, exactly.
And they are, by the way, making Spinal Tap 2 as we speak.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm amazed, actually. You know, it's now 40 years since I've been in the music business. The record work I did lives on. I mean, people know it. It's like some people collect it. The Boston cover is something people still write about, and I hate the album cover. And, you know, I don't understand how I even worked in the form. I think the industry was so specific that once you went into it, you were carried along by it. And you didn't even stop to step back to see the absurdity of it. Because in a funny way, when I work for clients now, everybody's very concerned about the strategy and what something means and how audiences are going to respond to it. There was no real marketing back in those days. You just made these things. You made these things and they got shipped all over the world. And people responded to them in relationship to the music. They used to hold them in their hands and they'd look at the information on the back and they would relate it to the music and they'd make up their own narrative in their head about what was really going on there. And it was this kind of manufactured fantasy that existed. And the form of the record cover was an amazing form for it, because it was an object. You could hold it, you could read it, and you could read into it, which was something that just is magical when you think about it. How many things do that?
And we don't have that anymore, right?
Paula, did you like invent the visual semiotics of rock and roll? Is that all you? Did you come up with, you know, the umlauts?
As far as I know, they only existed on Blue Oyster Cult. You know, they had, for some reason, they had them, and I didn't do that.
Motley Crue? And of course, famously, Spinal Tap has the umlaut over the N, which I love so much.
Well, of course. Well, you know, it is anything that hangs over is magical. You know, like any kind of form and nothing has to mean anything. So that's part of the wonderful thing of it. There'd be something that would be stuck and become part of a thing and then connected to a certain form of music, and it really meant nothing. There were just sort of accidental things that happened along the way. It was a kind of a combination of the absurdity of a rock and roll band, who some of them were actually very savvy and had really visual sensibility, and some of them just liked things that were irrelevant to maybe what they were doing, and they got put on album covers. And sometimes the audiences would connect whatever that craziness was with whatever that music was, and then you could never step away from it. Then they owned it.
It seems like that still happens on indie labels, too. I rewatched the movie this morning, and I was surprised by how little it feels dated, with the exception of the costuming. And maybe it's just the tone of the thing, that kind of deadpan humor that you see in Veep and shows like that. But it still felt very current to me.
Yeah, you know, I felt the same way about it. I didn't even mind the clothing. I mean, it was as I remembered it, and also hilariously funny. I mean, you know, the comedic performances are just terrific. I mean, to watch Michael McKean and Christopher Guest talk about their early days at the beginning of the movie and the little clips of the bands playing. I mean, that's what that stuff really did look like. It wasn't, some of it is just sort of almost perfect history in this bizarre way.
Right. They have a song about like fat bottom girls.
The lyrics to which I feel like we get away with saying a lot of things on this show, but like the lyrics to Big Bottom.
We will refrain from saying those. The looser the waistband, the deeper the quicksand, or so I have read. But there is an actual rock band, I think it's Queen, that has a similar song. It didn't seem absurd to me. It was like, oh yeah, this might be a real song already. I don't know.
Well, that's what was, that was the genius of the movie, because as I said, being in the industry, I thought it was docudrama. I did not think, oh, here they made this comedy, you know, because there were songs like that. And some of the lyrics are, in fact, filthy or suggestive, and some things are just downright offensive. You know, there were heavy metal bands that, you know, they scared me when they came up. I mean, they seemed so, you know, violent and sexist. And then there were really wonderful people who were, you know, very gentle and, you know, wrote beautiful songs. And the experiences of working with a recording artist and their sort of special personalities, and a lot of them were based against the kind of music they did. It wasn't all rock and roll. You know, there was jazz, there were classical, and they were crazy too. All in their special branded sort of way.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more Paula Scher.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Was your job to, like, bring out the crazy, to exaggerate it?
No. My job was to keep the bands happy, I guess. What I would do is I was East Coast art director, and I produced with a team maybe 150 covers a year. And I would try to solve, it was really, really trying to find a way to express something about the band or the album on a cover. And if it was all kinds of music, it wasn't just rock and roll, it was jazz, it was classical. Sometimes there was something called new music that came around for a while. There was a bunch of different forms, and they had different, there were different necessities. Like the rock and roll bands, I would say 90% of them were photographs of the band when the band started. And most of them, when they were startup bands, were on Epic Records, which was a very different kind of label from CBS or Columbia Records, because Columbia Records had, you know, Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen, and Bob Dylan, and sort of very, very established stars. And Epic Records had all the startup bands who could break it very big, much more like Spinal Tap. And one of the bands that I did a lot of work for was Cheap Trick. I think I did, you know, 5 album covers. And then on the first album cover, in those days, typography was produced on sheets of paper, and you cut out the type and you paste it on a board, and it was called a mechanical. And these were the things that how you produced liner notes that had lyrics and things like that. And we were doing their first album. I couldn't get the copy back on time because it had arrived to me too late. So I had to write the whole liner notes by hand. So I did it on the first album, and then it became a thing. So for the next 5 albums, I had to write all the liner notes by hand because the audience expected it. So there's a book publishing company called 33 and a Third, and they'd only write books about one album. And they wrote about Cheap Trick, and they had all this mystical belief about why it was, the handwriting was there, and there's sort of legends that are made up about it, and it's all on all their albums, so that must mean something. And it really never did. It was just, you know, it was a production thing. But you didn't, all stories emerge like that in connection with something. And you know, that was the fun of it, I guess.
What was your worst experience doing an album cover?
Oh, there were so many. No, they were, you know, I mean, usually it was the amount of people who had cover approval. Like, it could be a band, and then it could be the band and the band's manager, and then it could be the band and the band's manager and the band's wives, and then it could be the band and the band's manager and the band's wives and 7 nervous product managers from the label, you know. And you could never get a decision on anything, and it would just go on and on and on. And it was easier to do a cover for a very, very famous recording artist than a startup in a group because they were very insecure and they couldn't make decisions, so that you would be doing these things over and over again, and then you would be pushed to a deadline and forced to do almost anything. And that was there were a lot of those. So, you know, and they were all equally bad, I would say. And then there were people who were just wonderful to work with, like Muddy Waters, who I think was just a doll. He would do virtually anything that was suggested to him if it was a good idea, and he was really cooperative. I mean, Richard Avedon, I remember we went to see him, and he was going to photograph Muddy, and, you know, I expected about an hour photo session, and Muddy was wearing this terrific hat and coat, and Avedon saw him, and he just sort of pushed him up against a door that he was coming into and shot 7 pictures and said he had it, and he did. I mean, it was amazing. You know, I mean, so there was this broad variety of things that would happen. They were all over the map.
The trope of the girlfriend who comes in and has opinions and ends up breaking up the band.
If I told them once, I told them 100 times to put Spinal Tap first and Puppet Show last.
It's a morale builder, isn't it?
You've got a big dressing room, though, isn't it?
What?
You've got the big dressing room.
Oh, we've got a bigger dressing room than the Puppet Show. So that's
Emily, I want to know what you think about this and its inclusion in this movie.
Yeah, I that's an interesting one. I listened to something really great, I think a podcast that sort of went back and looked at Yoko and John and Paul and really like pulled it apart and kind of revealed just sort of all the sexist strands that were kind of going on there, the way that, you know, Yoko Ono was portrayed in the media as like breaking up the Beatles and how she became villainized and all that. So I was kind of thinking about that in Spinal Tap. And it's hard to know.
Exactly. And the thing was that, I hate to say it, but some of that was true. There were very sort of aggressive female partners who were sort of, you know, interfering in the management when there was a manager, you know, and I saw that on a number of instances. And because I think that there was a type of woman, I would say, and I hate to say type, who, you know, sort of fed off the talent of their spouse instead of doing their own thing. You know, they were powerful and smart in their own right, and they should have been doing their own thing. But in those days, it was hard to do your own thing.
Right. The opportunities really weren't there. So the whole structure is kind of messed up to start.
Right.
But in Spinal Tap, their band is going downhill so fast. It's like, you can't really blame. I mean, can you really blame for booking them at the amusement park? You know, I mean, is that her fault for booking them at the military base?
And she told them 100 times, first Spinal Tap, then Puppet Show.
She did make it clear, Puppet Show second. She's trying her best.
I love that. It's one of my favorite parts.
What about the set malfunctions? I feel like that's the thing that, like, if anyone remembers one thing from Spinal Tap, it's, you know, it's Stonehenge.
I think that the problem may have been that there was a Stonehenge monument on the stage that was in danger of being crushed by a dwarf.
Nigel gave me a drawing that said 18 inches, all right?
I know he did, and that's what
now,
I'm talking
whether
about.
He knows the difference between feet and inches is not my problem.
And that was the best, because it's the best visual joke, you know, the little drawing and
yeah.
What, feet and inches. I mean, yeah, that could happen. To be honest with you, that was the part of the movie where I understood that it was parody.
I laughed out. That was when I started just like dying, laughing out loud. The Stonehenge.
There are so many wonderful bits. And the idea that they knew the general tenor of the thing, and then they just made it up as they went along, which was astounding. You know, I Tony Henry told me some experiences. I remember the baseball bat was just happened to be lying there because somebody was going to go play after the shooting or something, and he picked it up, you know, and began using it as a prop.
Cricket bat, Paula, cricket.
Oh, excuse me. Whatever it was.
They improvised the exploding drummers and the dying drummers and the one.
No, not things where they needed the equipment. But, you know, like, you know, if there were probably things like, you know, they had to make the spot. I mean, I'm sure it was an improv idea initially, but the Stonehenge thing, you know, that had to be planned.
But I do have this feeling that, like, it was all just part of the improvised interview with the band where they talked about, you know, the deceased first drummer. You know, you can't dust for vomit, you know. And then they just ran with it at that point.
Like once they had made the joke once, it probably kept coming back into the improv situations. And it works partly because they just hammer it so relentlessly.
And then the guy explodes at the end.
So fantastic. Well, it's sort of, you know, there's one partner I have who's always has project managers that quit. And I told him, I thought that the analogy for that is the Spinal Tap drummer. You know, that if you have people that sort of blow up and disappear periodically, that was sort of the thing of that band where I really realized that that's actually something that generally happens to a certain type of person all the time with something, where it's this repetitive action. I wondered what caused the blow-ups. I mean, like, is it always a technical equipment malfunction, or is it just the fact that there's some sloppy thing going on in the life?
There's a Michael McKean line where he says something like, you know, people spontaneously combust all the time. It's just underreported.
I do remember in the 1980s, multiple conversations about spontaneous human combustion. And I'm quite sure that all of those can be traced back to Spinal Tap in one way or another.
I feel like that was a tabloid feature for a while, along with Bat Boy and sightings of the Loch Ness Monster, just people exploding randomly.
Well, also then there was the other musical part of it. Like, I just wonder if drummers on the whole are sort of expendable because they, if you know the band, so the drummers change the most.
Yeah. No one remembers the drummer.
It's true. Well, the Led Zeppelin drummer famously did die, John Bonham.
Yeah.
He was really drunk and he was sleeping on his back and he threw up and that's how he died. And I know the Rolling Stones cycled through two different drummers. So it definitely was a little bit of a thing. And then they made it a big thing. And now it's a cultural trope, right? I mean, Harry Potter, there's the instructor of the dark arts. They always, something really bad always happens to them.
There is the repetitive thing of something. It's some kind of a blow up, whether it's a personal blow up or a mechanical blow up, that they are repetitive in life.
I think my favorite parts of the movie are really where you can see them improvising on the spot. You know, you sort of see them thinking of what to say. And there's a scene, for example, where Christopher Guest's character is on stage and they're all wearing these outfits that make them look like druids.
In ancient times, hundreds of years before the dawn of history.
And he says, you know, they're an ancient race of people, the druids. And then he pauses and he says,
no one knows who they were or what they were doing.
And you can just see him doing that on the fly.
Well, it's also true. I don't know who they were or what they were doing.
And oh, how they danced, the little children of Stone Age.
I mean, there is truth in every, like, you know, for me, Christopher Guest in the ending, in the closing sequence with the you know, the credits going up and talking about being, you know, buying a chapeau and being the salesman in the store. And yes, I'd lock that. That would be good. I could do that. And you know, yeah, I guess that's that's a good trade. But, you know, I can see that once he had decided how he was going to answer that question, he could probably riff on it for another hour.
What about their musical, Saucy Jack?
Oh, Saucy Jack. Saucy Jack.
Jack the Ripper musical.
Yeah, Saucy Jack.
Well, I mean, but Sondheim had already done that at that point. It was called Sweeney Todd.
Yeah. I mean, they were all real. That point, that's why it was docudrama.
It's all real. We need to take a quick break, but after this, we will talk more about the absurdity that is the music industry. The Who, of course, are English. Like, there was a very deliberate choice made to make these guys English.
Mm.
The actual actors, only one of them was English, as far as I know.
Yeah, I did think about The Who, because The Who started out as more like a gentle kind of rock band, folksy, right?
Right.
And then they moved to more heavy.
Well, they got dark.
Yeah. Quadrophenia. No one knows what it means.
But I think there's something about the English accent, especially when you've got, like, you know, a Canadian actor sort of putting on an English accent. It just helps get you into that character because it's so deadpan funny. Just the accent alone, it wouldn't have worked the same way with any other accent.
It's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it?
Well, there's this other kind of truth there also, and if you go into the period, American rock and roll, which influenced the whole world, particularly British musicians, by the late 60s, early 70s, it had moved into a British invasion. And they were sort of, in a funny way, pretenders. Like what was interesting to me was, you know, meeting the African-American artists who invented so much of the music against the sort of really, to a degree, imposters who'd come over and stole it. And, you know, it's true, the Rolling Stones, and it's true so many of British bands who were, you know, I mean, John Lennon wanted to do nothing but play 1950s and 60s rock and roll. And that's what he was doing when he came back to the States. So that there was something about the theft of it and then coming back and doing it and being phenomenally successful about it. And of course, the Beatles rewrote everything. But if you think about that in relationship to the time, that's part of what makes that so silly.
And by the time Spinal Tap came out and it had made its way like across the pond and back again, it had become inherently sort of stretched or diluted or changed enough that it was easy to lampoon it in this way. Like, it, you know, it would be much harder to lampoon Muddy Waters.
No, you couldn't. But Muddy Waters could have written Big Bottom and done it really well. No, seriously. But, you know, I just think that the characterization of Spinal Tap from the name all the way through is such perfect parody. And I don't remember it really existing that well in any other movie. I think it's Christopher Guest's best movie of all the ones he made.
It was the original Christopher Guest mockumentary, and then that became his career, right? Like, he basically, I mean, obviously he pops up in The Princess Bride and in various other movies, but what he's known for is a series of mockumentaries that would never have happened without Rob Reiner and Spinal Tap. And they are awesome. They are fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan, but this one just takes the cake. I wonder how, I never found out how long it took them to make it. I think it was like very fast. I think it's something they did very quickly.
Yeah, that, I think this one as well, Spinal Tap 2, they're filming right now and they have a plan to bring it out in the spring in like March or April or something. I think the turnaround is fast. Can I also mention 82 minutes, I think, the running time of Spinal Tap? Like, perfect. This is the perfect length for a movie. Like, we need more movies that break the 90-minute mark. Like, every movie is too long now.
I mean, I thought this could have been shorter, honestly. Don't you think it could have been a little shorter? Because it's basically a comedy sketch. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be. I was like, this could be 15 minutes, you know? Like, if it was made now, it would be like Netflix, 4 episodes.
This movie came out very shortly after The Last Waltz, right? That was the clear inspiration for it.
1978.
But yeah, like, I feel like it. After Spinal Tap, it was impossible to do a movie like The Last Waltz with a straight face anymore. It becomes so much harder to take these bands seriously. Like, you need a sort of comic wink.
Yeah, I mean, I took the band seriously. It was a Scorsese documentary. It was like beautifully made and filmed. I even like watching it now. And, you know, there was real artistry in that. And this was so absurd. This was, and in my experience with it, there were artists with a capital A, and then there were these bands that came and went. And that Spinal Tap was definitely the came and went band. And and still going. Still.
They're in the Where Are They Now file, Paula.
Well, it's Where Are They Now and Why. No, I mean, it really is. It's really, they are silly. And you know, I just never saw the band as silly. So it's sort of, I don't think I ever connected the two.
I did read somewhere that Scorsese was quite upset at Spinal Tap when it came out and then slowly sort of came around to it.
Well, he probably thought it was, you know, he probably thought it was real life.
I mean, it was clearly based on him, right? The fact that the director put himself in the movie on film was a very Scorsese move.
Huh.
Taken straight from The Last Waltz.
Yeah.
I think it also has Song Remains the Same, the Led Zeppelin concert movie, because Led Zeppelin does all that like druid stuff. And the way that when the Spinal Tap is performing and the way the camera angles up at their faces is very Led Zeppelin-y too, I thought.
There is a lot of Led Zepp in Spinal Tap.
I see much more than the band. You know, I mean, that.
Oh, yeah, totally. And musically, it's Led Zepp.
Totally.
And I like Led Zeppelin, but after I watched this, I was kind of like, oh, man. I'm glad I haven't seen this. I hadn't seen it before.
Well, there was also a thing with bands where they would, you know, they'd be starting out with sort of like a little bit of good old fashioned rock and roll, and then they'd start to veer into this mystical stuff, which is, you know, the Stonehenge bit. You know, they're going to tell the story of the mystical past. I never understood that. Does that still go on, or is
I think it's over now. I think it's very much over now.
Thank God.
We should probably wrap this up, but first we need letter grades. Elizabeth?
A+, perfect movie for me.
I
love everything Christopher Guest does.
Emily?
Don't get mad. B+? I need a little more something for a movie. It could have been shorter. Sorry.
Actually, you mean you need a little less something.
Maybe a little less. I don't know.
I'm giving it... Yeah, I think... I don't know. If A+ is possible, I'll give it an A. I reserve my A+ for The Princess Bride. Paula?
Well, I would give it an A. I think it's maybe the third or fourth funniest comedy, which it's hard to do a good comedy. So I give it an A. It's not the funniest I've ever seen, but it is really funny. A little long, I agree.
Compared to When Harry Met Sally, which I guess Rob Reiner made just not that much later, which one's funnier?
Oh, I think I laugh louder at Spinal Tap. Harry Met Sally is more like, you know, it's you could call it a comedy, but it's a comedy drama. It's really not, it's not absurd. It's not making.
Yeah, it doesn't have the absurdity. We love the absurd, and there's nothing more absurd than the music industry.
Rock and roll is not much of a thing anymore. Elizabeth, you tell us, you know.
I think you're failing to anticipate the Taylor Swift druid phase.
Her and Travis Kelce putting on cloaks. Machines. I don't know what happens in Kansas City.
All right. Thank you for coming on the show. And thank you to Ben Richmond and Jared Downing for putting the show together. And we will be back on Saturday with a regular Slate Money.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.